1985. I guarantee you, Tom Petty just snorted some blow. Days are gone, Jack.
I like that a lot.
There's no sense in pretending.
It's your eyes, you're away.
Something inside your spirit, like I do. You said, oh, it's the same.
Friday night on the West Coast. I guess the sun may be going down over there on the Hawaiian Islands with Epic Journeyman. Here with Bruce McDonald. Thanks for being here. What's up, TalkStream Live? Pacific, you'll find us here. you've been talking about the intervention of a power greater than yourself, the AI. Does it exist outside your perception of its ability to understand the world around you in a way that's impossible for you to perceive? Is your situational awareness the same? Maybe it is. I don't know. We've been talking about it. We're going to talk about some comedy this hour here. We're talking about language, you know. Does the, you know, when the language changes, when the language changes, when it's okay to say this, and now it's not okay, and you didn't get the memo, but all of a sudden you're just acting like you always have. You think certain stuff's funny because, you know, when you grew up, that's what you were taught was funny. Because they played a certain laugh, didn't they, Epic German? They made jokes and then they had a laugh.
Laugh tracks, yeah. And prompted like, you to laugh.
Yeah.
Laugh, but rather.
Back then, when people were watching TV and they heard the laughing, they weren't of the mind of ever even considering that that wasn't real laughing, that there wasn't, because you thought there was a studio audience every time there was a TV show that was on. So people didn't at that time even have this perception that there's something weird going on. You know, they didn't understand the magic of playing those sounds, you know, and making people think a certain thing is going on, right? What happened to you?
Yeah, Gilligan's Island is the best example, probably, where you know that you should have known there's no studio audience, right? They're on an island. Even the studio set, there's no room for the audience on that set, right? But yeah, people did it for years. People just laughed along. I mean, then it got to be kind of so obvious. People who were, you know, hip to it, that they started filming more shows.
But unbeknownst to the people, like in the studio audience, the producer would come out and go, okay. You know, hey man, you know, blah blah blah. You know, when you see this sign here that says,
it says laugh.
Yeah, we'll let you come here and sit in the room with these people that you consider to be celebrities or you know whatever it is. We'll let you sit in there with them, but you gotta laugh and applaud when you see this sign. You know what I mean? So, I mean, really, that's the ultimate example of the rude example of exactly what we're talking about. But so now, all of a sudden, there's generations of people that were programmed to laugh at a certain thing or think a certain thing is funny. And now, there's generations of people who are programmed to think that if you think that's funny, it's hurtful. And if you really, I mean, if you really dig down deep in your soul and think about some of the stuff that's funny, it is actually hurtful. You know, I mean, even though you're still going to laugh at it because you've been programmed to think something's funny, but I'm just saying, if you really consider it, some of the stuff where people made fun of people, you know, was hurtful to people, did hurt people's feelings or whatever. And it seems like, you know, the hurting of feelings in the future is not going to be tolerated, man. You know, you can't go around hurting feelings anymore. And on some level, it's like saying you're not for drunk driving, Epic Journeyman, are you?
Wait. No, of course not.
How are you going to say no to this, what we're saying right now? How do you say no to this? Go ahead. How do you say no to it?
Well, that's going to be the dilemma, right? It's going to create a dilemma every time, where the logic is going to be such that you can't argue the logic, because the alternative is that humor. I mean, what happens when an AI decides to just, you know, if it adopts humor with like the Three Stooges, let's say, for example, and starts doing practical jokes of physical, you know, pain on people? Well, we laugh at it and think that's funny at the time, back in, you know, when we were growing up as kids or something. But that's not cool, right? So the distinction has to be, yeah.
We should just reduce everything to one punchline and everyone laughs at it and that's it.
Right. You know, that's your cue. It's a cue.
Yeah. You don't need comedians anymore.
It's that sign. It's that sign, but it's a Pavlovian response, right? Exactly. You see a particular color, you laugh instantly. You see a particular word said, it's just
like TX1138. You just buy the plastic.
Yeah.
And throw it in the hole or whatever. And that's, you know, that has to create the nut, that creates the juice, that creates the society. Because you got to make a certain amount of money to keep the operation going. And then, you know, got to make a minimum amount of money every single day to make the operation move forward. So our operation is moving forward here. It's 11:11 on the West Coast. Bruce McDonald, are you still there? I cannot see him. I do not know if he's there. But
that they're feeding the jaguars, you know.
He might be feeding jaguars, but you never do know. So anyway, so even the TV shows, like let's just drop back to say, if you look at a show like say All in the Family, you know, All in the Family. I mean, today and by today's standards, All in the Family is like a racist thing or whatever. But the thing about
it's
it was
a completely racist thing by today's standards, yeah.
But the thing about it wasn't the show wasn't popular because people liked Archie Bunker. The show was popular because it showed a particular stereotype. You know, then people thought that the stereotype was funny and ridiculous. It wasn't that people were resonating with this idea that he was putting forward, that that's a mentality. That is a certain mentality with a certain group of people. You know, but it's funny. It's just funny that, you know, the people next door spun off into their own show, which was sort of racist in and of itself, too. Only in the opposite direction.
You know, I found what I consider to be absolute proof that that was a operation completely, that those shows. And it's in the form of Carl Reiner, because Carl Reiner went to the Georgetown School of Foreign Service. He went to spook you. You only go there if you're going to be a spy, an ambassador, or a world leader. You don't go there to produce comedies and sitcoms unless it's part of something else.
Yeah.
And he went there.
Exactly, dude. Well, I mean, you could expand on that if you'd like to, because we didn't prepare this, but I mean, come on in here if you got something that has a little bit of meat on it. But I mean, I'll just say there was a certain there was a certain group of people that put out really, I mean, wouldn't you consider for example, Young Frankenstein or Blazing Saddles, you know, excuse me while I whip this out or whatever, you know what I mean, the dope smoking black dude or whatever, you know what I mean? Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I was gonna get something together with Reiner because the thing is, and that's another guy, Buck Henry and Mel Brooks. So the whole thing with chaos and control, that's real. That's not fake. I mean, they make a comedy out of it, but that's true. That's MI6 Inspector. I mean, they make a comedy out of it, but that is true. That is the way the world works. And they're making fun of it on TV and people laugh at it like, ah, ha, ha, it's all cool. No, it's not cool. that is really the way things work.
I mean, it's just funny because any of those people now, like the Mel Brooks comedies and the stuff we're talking about, this stuff couldn't fly now. Norman Lear, too. Yeah, good one, Cub. Exactly. Norman Lear. So it's Lear, Brooks, and who did you say?
Carl Reiner.
Reiner. Yeah. And look at the longevity of his, I mean, wasn't he involved in Spinal Tap, too?
He might have been. I'm not sure. Dick Van Dyke Show.
He was, yeah.
Corporal. Alan Brady Show. Dead Men Were Playing. There's a bunch of movies. But I'm going to go for the TV shows here. There's so many. Sid Caesar. Yes, I mean, it goes on. It goes on and on and on. Dinah Shore.
Cab in the chat saying, "Get Smart and Hogan's Heroes." Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's not Reiner, but I mean, Then the son, right? And then the people on the show. So Norman Lear, is all in the family. But so when you look at how far back this goes, when you're talking about the Madison Avenue ad man, right? As the song goes, Madison Avenue man, right?
Yeah.
That was when they first started pointing to the fact of how much influence these advertisers had, right? Because they're using these techniques that were pioneered in World War II, right? Right. I mean, they are. And so
what about Sanford and Son?
Oh yeah, I always think about Sanford and Son. It's a great series. I hate to think about the worst.
What was that big old ugly lady that used to come over? She looks just like that. Just like that senator, man.
Oh yeah, yeah. the Congress lady. Yeah. She does actually. I'm trying to think of her name. It'd be in chat.
That shit was funny, man. Think of all the comedians that sprang out of those shows. They were actual. Did they spring out of the shows or their careers? They were happening before because there was a second. There's like a second surge of comedians that entered the movie scene. This was like this big wave of comedy that happened with the Andrew Dice Clay. And what's his face? There's so many great comedians, man, over the years. But we're talking.
I was typing. I had the.
Yeah, no worries, no worries. So, but the point is that a lot of what's gone on in the past could not fly now. And I think they recently redid All in the Family. And they had like Woody Harrelson was playing Archie. Did you know that? I mean, I think it was like a thing or whatever. They, it's like TV or something, made for TV movie or something.
I didn't hear the first part. I was reading about Norman Lear, catching up on him a little bit. Yeah, because just the things we all mentioned, all his shows actually, All in the Family, Maude, Sanford and Son, One Day at a Time, Jefferson's, Good Times. he's check it out. His family, his mom and dad, one's from Russia and one's from Ukraine. How odd is that? How appropriate is that?
Oh man, come on.
Yeah, but the people that we talked about Lear. What makes this really interesting is the people on his shows. What they did in conjunction with around those shows. So Rob Reiner's, Carl Reiner's son, was in All in the Family, right? And Sally Struthers. I mean, what is she known for? She's not known for that show as much as Please Give, right? Those commercials she used to do, Please Give to the Children's Fund International or whatever it was. It's got tears in her eyes.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like that, if you're talking about psychological operation or a plan, that is one. That image, that meme is in everybody's, it's to this day. People who've never seen it All in the Family will laugh at a South Park reference to Sally Struthers because they've seen that. You know what I mean? I mean, that's the thing. And I can't help but think there's intent behind any and most of that. I mean, it's just, it's amazing to me.
What about this one? What about this, man? Check this out.
Welcome back. Your dreams were your ticket out. Welcome back.
Up your nose. With a rubber hose.
Well, the names have all changed since you hung around, but those dreams have remained and they've turned around.
What? Remember John Travolta and this stupid guy? Whatever. The stupid honk. The lovable stupid honk.
And then right. And now he's a Scientologist. Yeah.
And John Travolta. I'm just saying he springboard that shit into like.
Oh, he sure did.
Wasn't there tragedy around Welcome Back, Kotter?
There was. Didn't he commit suicide? I thought he did. I'll have to look that up. Something happened. Maybe he died prematurely. But
Rorschach?
The guy plays Kotter. Yeah. Well, no, the guy played Kotter, right?
Oh, hold Kotter.
On. He committed suicide. Well, I'll have to look it up. Something happened. Because also the guy, Chico and the Man, that guy killed himself. But I thought there's something.
Freddie?
Yeah, Freddie Prinze. But
Prinze, yeah, the horror of the 70s comedy people.
But this is gold. This is gold about Norman Lear, you know, because he joins Air Force at the time that Lookout Mountain. He doesn't mention Lookout Mountain, but when that was getting started up, right? So there's a possibility there. But his dad sold junk bonds. He went to prison for selling junk bonds, and Archie Bunker's based on him, right? And then there's this thing with Charles Coughlin, Father Charles Coughlin. He's a guy who started the was supposed to be a coup against Roosevelt, and they had all these. It was the first white nationalist movement. Where they're going to take over the government and do a coup. And it was this Father Charles Coughlin guy. And so that guy was tinkering with his radio. He met the guy.
Gabe Kaplan.
Gabe Kaplan.
He committed suicide, huh?
But we'll find out here in a second. I recall it, Beck. You were calling wrong.
Well, be the Google Meister, because I don't know. I thought there was... I
know Freddie Prinze did, but
empathically now, I'm looking at the picture, the group shot of... the teacher in the middle. I always thought it was kind of weird that the kids were hanging out over at the teacher with his wife's house.
Well, he's still alive, man. He became a professional poker player.
I always thought
that's a Mandela effect to me right there, dude. I swear that guy has passed away years ago.
Dude, I always thought it was weird that John Travolta was over there hanging around Gabe Kaplan's wife. While he wasn't home. I thought that was kind of strange. But, I mean, who am I to judge? I mean, you know, he's just a kid or whatever in high school.
Right, because we all know high school kids don't have any hormones or... yeah.
He's just 6'4" and John Travolta or whatever.
Yeah.
Over to Italia or whatever. He's like, what? You know, I don't know. Did he get into construction later on? I'm not sure.
Gabe Kaplan or John Travolta?
No, seriously, though. So you had Horshack. So you had Gabe Kaplan. This is a multiracial classroom. You had Mr. Cotter. And then you had John Travolta on the one hand and Lionel. What was that dude's name? What was the black dude's name that was in there? Lionel something. Forget his name. Then you had I think the guy was a Puerto Rican dude because he had sort of a natural,
I think so too.
Almost an afro, but not quite. I would call it a natural.
I'm still tripping out of Gabe Kaplan being alive and being a professional player in the poker tournaments. What the hell?
Epstein, exactly. Juan Epstein, exactly, Cab. Man, Cab knows his shit.
Yeah, well, I'm telling you.
If Cab was on a game show right now, he'd be in the $10,000 square.
Right. I'd be down to zero. I'd be down my last $100 on Double Jeopardy or whatever right now. With the Gabe Kaplan thing.
Freddie Boom Boom. Yeah, see, that would be considered, you know, racist. Now, I was watching some Richard Pryor earlier. I don't know. Rio is a... people are asking about Rio. As far as I know, everything's okay. He's just buried with a bunch of this stuff that's going on with his work and these cars. So, you know, that's basically what's going on. So I'm not sure what happened to Bruce, but he'll be back when he can. And if he will, then he will be. But other than that, here we are. So we're talking about this. And so earlier today, I was listening to some a Richard Pryor mafia joke. And I gotta say, I mean, I busted out laughing a couple of times, man. And the thing is like a lot of times you think something's funny. In other words, you hear a joke, but you don't like bust out laughing. You know, it's hard to make somebody bust out laughing. Don't you think? It's easy. I mean, you can be sarcastic.
No, spontaneous humor that actually hits you is a gift.
Well, isn't sarcasm a silent joke? In other words, it's only funny if you're smart enough to understand the sarcasm.
And it can also be an insult, right? So that's what makes sarcasm, two-edged. It could be biting sarcasm could be humorous.
Yeah, I know a dude who's so sarcastic. He's on the level of sarcasm that he say some shit to a guy. And then leave the room, and the guy wouldn't even understand the sarcasm or get it until he left. And then when he did, he would just realize he shredded him with 1,000 razor blades. You know what I mean? So, I mean, on some level, in order for you to even understand the joke, you got to be somewhat familiar with, you know, brain work. Some stuff's funny. Like I say, it's funny, but it's funny on an intellectual level. In other words, you think it's funny. You know what I mean? But then there's other shit that makes you laugh out loud. And that's the stuff, see, that's the stuff now that has become, you know, illegal for you to, express this emotion where you're laughing out loud at something. It's the kind of comedy that happens now is like, you can't outwardly think something's funny, so you have to hold it inside and it has to be an intellectual thought. But now your cognitive liberty is under surveillance, you know, with ubiquitous emotional control by these mechanisms, you know, headsets, earphones, watches, whatever that is, Epic Journeyman. But the thing is busting out laughing out loud. It's like these shows. We played that Tom Petty a little earlier, and you hear the crowd out there singing and having a good time. It's back in 1985. You know, they were drinking, just having fun, and they weren't considering any of the shit. You know? They were just having a good time. And that's the way it used to be. You used to go somewhere to have a good time, you know, and you didn't have to worry that you're having that good time, you know.
So it didn't matter if people overheard you, you didn't have to worry about the thought police coming in.
Or that you were laughing at a certain joke.
Inappropriate joke, yeah.
That's what I mean. And then all of a sudden there was this net over the top of everything that decided what was appropriate and what wasn't. And so today, you know, the community guideline changes on a daily basis. You don't know what guideline you're breaking and when you're breaking it. In other words, for example, you don't have a Stephen Wright. You don't have an example of a breaking a rule until you find out there is a rule, until you broke the rule. And then you find out the consequences of breaking the rule are, you know, inescapable. So now there's nothing you can do about it. You didn't know it was a rule till you broke it. And now that you broke it, you know, well, Epic Journeyman, you understand. Yeah, Sam Kinison, that's exactly what I was talking about earlier. I just couldn't think of his name. So Sam Kinison and Andrew Dice Clay, that was in the second wave of comedy. Where stand-up comedy became big and comedy stars became like rock stars, like literally, like what is Andy Dice Clay's real name? Do you know?
I used to. I don't know. I remember when it first came out.
Check it out. It's interesting. But no, they became huge, those guys, and that was the second wave. All those guys, a lot of people got into the movies. You know, obviously, Andrew Dice Clay did Ford Fairlane or whatever, but I mean, there was just a period of time. And, you know, if you were to say those jokes that Andrew Dice Clay was to say today, they would string him up by his nuts in public.
I mean, Andrew Clay Silverstein. Yeah, I knew it was Silverstein or something like that, yeah.
Is he related to the Silverstein movie name?
I'm going to find out. You know, the thing is, like, he got to start like in 16 Candles, right? And what's the other one with all the Brat Pack kids? Not Breakfast Club, but one of those other spinoffs. The one with the guy from Alien. that was 16 Candles, right?
So. Yeah. What was that dude's?
Pretty pink.
You know that movie Swingers?
Yeah, you know, I never seen Swingers all the way through. Can you believe it?
Get out of here.
It used to rent out all the time, and I'd start to watch this movie when I rent it, and I never...
That movie's funny, That movie's funny, but listen, there's a dude in that movie. He's like the main guy, you know, the main character, John Favreau. Is this guy, this actor? What's really funny is earlier today, I was watching this scene from A Bronx Tale. And it's the scene where this motorcycle biker gang comes into this bar that is where these, you know, it's the clubhouse of this brotherhood. Of these, you know, Italian-American guys. They had this little clubhouse there, and it's like a bar. So all of a sudden, here comes like 30 bikers into this bar, and they want to have a drink or whatever. So they come in, and the bartender says, "You can't drink here." You don't pass the dress code. And so they start getting wrestling around, start getting pissed off. And then all of a sudden, here comes the Godfather dude. He comes in and he says, they tell him, hey, you know, we just want to have a beer or whatever. And he goes, okay, go ahead. You can have a beer. So they all get beers, you know, and they open the beers and they basically shake the beers up and they start squirting the beers behind, you know, the bar on the bartenders. And they just go, you know, hey, you know, F you, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so then the Godfather, he looks at him and he goes over and he closed the door. He said, you know, I told you, I asked you guys, you know, nicely, I told you. And now yous can't leave, you know. And then they kick their ass, Epic Journeyman. They kick their ass all the way out the door. And the funniest thing was, as each one of these bikers turned around and looked at the Godfather, I noticed one of them, he was only in it for a minute. He was only in the movie for 1 minute. It was Jon Favreau. Like he was a biker with a fake goatee, sticking his jaw out, about to get hit in the face with a baseball bat by a goombas coming out of the back door. These giant guys come out of the back and kick these bikers' asses all the way down the street, and then the kids kick their bikes over and beat them with sticks. They're playing stickball out in front.
Now that name's going to catch on, man. The backdoor goombas.
I don't know, man. That's what they say. In the movie, yeah. There's like a narration or whatever. And he's just like, that's when the Goombas came out or whatever.
I remember that line. I did see that part. Yeah, I watched parts of it. Like I said, I tried to watch it a couple times. And every time I'd be watching, hey, what you watching? That looks good. They'd rent it and then I didn't get to watch it. Back in my video store days, I'd watch shows, you know, while the...
Is that a negative term for an Italian-American?
I have to ask Rio.
I just don't know. I mean, hopefully I didn't offend anyone by saying that.
Well, no, because it's, you know, the song, you know.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it could have been offensive to someone right now.
And it can't be that offensive because they played in a commercial, right, for the old lady crew that just they're making a second movie now, whatever that's called, the one that had Tom Brady, the first one, and it's Sally Field and all those people, yeah.
I'm just saying, man, you could just be oblivious. I mean, I don't know. Maybe that's a derogatory term. You could just be saying something you heard and think it's okay to say, but maybe it's derogatory. You never know. I don't know.
But that's the problem. I mean, it's the ignorance of the law. Excuse, right? But what about ignorance of social protocol? I mean, you know, something that's hilarious in your neck of the woods. You grew up, especially back in the old days, before we had this kind of internet and communication system we have today, where everybody sees the same shows potentially or has some kind of exposure. What if you grew up in, you know, somewhere in the Midwest and you went out to California or went the other way around, California to there, and you have all these sayings and things that mean nothing to you, and all of a sudden you're in trouble? Like today, I mean, older people, people our age, electricians and stuff, it's not uncommon at all. A guy got in trouble at my work a couple years ago. For saying, hey, man, pass me the dikes. He was talking about the diagonal cutters, right? He had to go to HR and all that stuff. I told the story before. It's true. I mean, you can't say that. It was in the management stairwell at the building, and, he got in big trouble. They wanted to fire him for just saying, pass me the dikes. I mean, it's a normal term.
Is, man, just be quiet and keep your mind on what you're doing and don't look over here to the side.
Well, his bio was what he was doing. He needed his tool. he needed his diagonal cutters. That's what they're called, dykes, back in the day. And then he made another reference. He was trying to save himself, right? He says, no, it's no different than talking about the broad jump, you know?
Well, man, all I'm saying is, listen, the thing is what we're moving into this period of time where we don't know when what we say is going to be considered to be wrong by someone. And who the someone is. You know, are the someones that are going to be in charge of that someone that we have been exposed to and made a decision about to be the one to sit over the top of everything? Because it seems like we were talking about earlier, the only one that's possibly going to be able to do something like that is the very thing that we can't have doing the thing that we need.
Right, right. Well, you know, I think we're making a good concept for a TV show or a movie right now. you know, the AI doesn't laugh. It'd be all about the fact that humor's outlawed, right? And everybody's going to have secret comedy clubs, and they tell jokes in secret, you know, that kind of thing. It'd be like Fahrenheit 451 for they'll bring back all the old 90s comics in their old age, right? They'll be out there, you know, performing in these little, you know.
I mean, even that Kramer, dude. Kramer.
You got canceled originally, yeah.
That's what I mean.
He was hilarious in UHF, right, before he became a guy on the Seinfeld show. You know, that was his break into stardom. UHF. Weird Al Yankovic.
Man, see, the thing is like, you know, we're caught in this loop. You know what I mean? And it's like, as much as people don't want to admit it, and the thing is that if you don't go along to, you know, with the program, then you're not going to have some of the situations that you have. So in other words, I gambled and I knew that at some time that could happen to our channel. But I knew, I mean, that was part of the game. In other words, I always knew that going into it. So I knew that was an eventual possibility. So, but even still, and knowing what I know, and when language changed, we had to change our language. So there became a point where we had to reference Michelle Pfeiffer. And when talking about a certain aspect of what was going on during the pandemic, you know, there were certain things that we've had to do. Certain ways we've had to monitor what we say and say it in a certain way, and certain things we find out about later that we didn't know about. And it's like I was talking about earlier, you know, evidence of revision, because all of a sudden a certain activity that goes on every 4 years or every 2 years, if you say it or talk about it in any way, it's immediately deleted, and I don't want to go. I can't take any chances here.
Right? No, exactly. I mean, it's dangerous enough talking about dykes and broad jump.
I mean, you know. There you go.
So check it out. So it's gonna be like a Dark Mirror episode. You guys are hearing my pitch right now. So if that's a Starbucks would be written tomorrow, I'd lose it. But you guys you're in on it, right? So the idea is, the episode starts with these people that have to turn on their phones, they get scanned for electronic devices, right? They go through this like jungle tunnel with all this foliage and stuff around it, and they go into this, Bruce's place with his pillows and stuff out there, the ayahuasca shaman out there, where you think it is. It turns out to be one of these old comics, and they start doing the comedy stand-up shows. That's all it is. And it's a secret thing. You have to have these passwords, like a speakeasy thing to get in there.
Yeah,
and the group starts growing larger and larger, and they start becoming accused of being renegades and rebels. Right.
Just because.
But all they are is comic fans.
They're just belly laughing.
Right. Exactly.
All of a sudden, laughing becomes illegal.
Yeah.
And you just have to go someplace quiet to laugh, to gently laugh at what you were trained.
Right. You got to be AI free. You got to leave your electronic devices home and all that stuff. You got to get scanned to go in there. You know. Yeah. I like it. It's a Dark Mirror episode. I'm hopping on right now, guys.
All right. Well, listen. Only got about 30 minutes left of Into the Microcosm. You can find us here Friday nights. Tomorrow night, we're on the Independent Broadcast Network. We're going to be talking about Disney tomorrow night. Not just Disney in the sense that you might be thinking, but there's aspects of the Disney operation. Disney's on everyone's mind, obviously. There's been a lot of Disney programming for our children where, you know, you heard the word Disney and it had the Disney stamp on it. So, like we were saying earlier, once something becomes trusted, then after that, there's no more investigation to make sure. They just go ahead and trust it. And so, you know, there's been a lot of children sat down in front of a lot of Disney material. But, you know, we're going to talk about Walt Disney. We're going to talk about his connections to some of these agencies. We're going to talk about some of the psychological programming and engineering that was done in the beginning with some of the visuals that were being put out by the Disney organization, Epic Journeyman. And of course, then there's the whole other aspect of it. Can't really go into here on tonight.
You got to leave your electronic devices behind. Got to scan. Got to have the password. Yep.
Hands up, man. No Googling. We're watching you. your screen is a two-way, just like we said earlier, you're transmitting, you're also receiving. You know what I mean? Sleep, sleep, sleep. They're all around you. They're all about you. They came and got that guy, didn't they? Club 33. Yeah, Club 33, among other things. There's a whole secret society that developed out of the Walt Disney. Remember that one? There was people that Tracy Twyman was actually investigating this.
The tunnel thing?
No, well, she was investigating this secret society that supposedly is a joke. It's a make-believe secret society. But in reality, it's not make-believe. And in reality, the secret society does exist. And in reality, there is this alternative potential reality that exists that only certain people have access to. It exists on another plane of existence.
Tomorrowland, yeah?
Tomorrowland, exactly. So, anyway, we'll be talking about that tomorrow night. You can join us.
No pun intended.
Yeah. So, Independent Broadcast Network, it'll be 7 o'clock Pacific. And you can join us for that over there. We appreciate it. And I'm sure you'll appreciate it. I mean, if you got nothing better to do on a Saturday night. I know. I must have nothing going on at Epic Journeyman because I'm here every Saturday night. I'm here every Friday night. I'm right here. You know, it's like I never leave. I just come alive from the waist up. I'm just an animatronic.
You're one of those holograms that was on 60 Minutes on Sunday. I'm telling you, that's it. You're not going to be able to tell a difference at all in the future. And actually, you'll be in 3D in our room and everything. I will be. We'll all be there. You won't be able to tell a difference. It's going to be that good. And it already almost is. It's almost that good right now.
I'm sure it is that good already. Just like
I'm sure it probably is too. I mean, with the like show.
He said Ray Kurzweil saying 2050.
No, I've been following Ray Kurzweil since the 80s, and you know, he invented the Kurzweil sound sampling computer, so he's all about mimicking reality, right? He's the original transhumanist. I mean, that's his thing. And so I was reading Scientific American when he made that, and then he did the scanner, right? Mm-hmm. So the digital scanner, fax machine, and then he did speech to text, right? And all these things are about making, if you think about it, it's all about making the virtual, the digital, have a physical presence in the real world. It's all about this transition. So like he wants to bring his dad back. That was his motivation originally. We should do a show about, I would like to have lunch with the guy. Actually, he's one of the most interesting people he could probably talk to. He's a character, man, and he wants to bring his dad back. He's trying to reincarnate his dad through technology. That's honest to God what he's trying to do. that was his goal for all this.
We should try to get Zoltan back.
He's out of Oxford now. He's free. He's out doing He's doing gigs again. Maybe he's going to run for president in 2024.
Could be. That's what I say, man.
He could.
We brought him to the table. We let people hear his platform. You know what
I
mean?
Him and Andrew Yang. Yeah, him and Andrew Yang. I can see it totally.
Yang, Zoltan.
Yep. Zoltan Yang. That is a better ring. Zoltan Yang.
It sounds
like a villain from Flash Gordon, doesn't it?
Zoltan Yang.
The evil Ming.
Zoltan Yang.
Zoltan Yang. His most formidable lieutenant. Yeah.
That reminds me, you could sing it to the song Panama Red. Remember that song? Panama Red, Panama Red. It'll kick you in the head. Remember that? You could sing it.
Zoltan Yang. Coming in with the bang. Yeah,
they don't run with the gang.
Oh yeah, a whole new gang. There you go.
His name's Joe, and he's going with the flow. All right, listen. We only got 15 minutes left. Listen, every minute is precious, ladies and gentlemen. Every moment is precious, and it's one. It's unique. It'll never happen again. And if you're in it, and whoever's in it with you, or you're in it by yourself. To say, it's never going to happen again like that. It's a moment to be remembered, ladies and gentlemen. Don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle happens, ladies and gentlemen. I'm telling you right now. But in the meantime, there's one aspect of life that will make everyone's life happier. You think of a river, okay? Think of the water, and it's running down the river, okay? But you want to go up the river, okay? No matter what you do, you can swim and swim and swim you want and swim until you can't swim no more. Eventually, your arms, your legs will give out, and you'll float. And when you do, what happens, Epic Journeyman? Where do you go?
Go downstream.
That's right. So what's the idea then? The idea would be then go with the flow. All right. We've got a few minutes left. Here, I'm going to use 7 minutes of my precious time with you tonight, ladies and gentlemen, to show how to go and enter the flow state.
Flow is often described as a state of kind of effortless effort. We feel like we're propelled through the activity. Everything else just seems to disappear. Time is going to dilate, which is a fancy way of saying it's going to pass strangely. 5 hours go by in like 5 minutes. Occasionally, it'll slow down. You get a freeze frame effect. I mean, anybody who's been in a car crash, for example. Intuition tends to get turned up a lot. This is a basketball player in the zone, seeing the hoop, and suddenly it's as big as a hula hoop. And our frown muscles tend to be paralyzed. And what that frowning is a sign that the brain is doing work. This is a constant issue in my marriage where my wife thinks I'm mad at her or somebody. And I'm like, no, I'm just thinking. This is just me thinking. I'm in robot mode.
All right. So this is Stephen Kotler. Epic Journeyman. Are you familiar with him? Epic Journeyman is checking the perimeter. All right, listen. Let's get into this here.
My name is Stephen Kotler. I'm a writer and a researcher, and my latest book is The Art of Impossible. Flow itself, actually, the term is coined by Goethe, who uses the German word Rausch, which means overflowing with joy. Nietzsche actually wrote about flow. William James worked on the topic, but Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi is often referred to as the godfather of flow psychology. He was very interested in sort of well-being, meaning of life, and he went around the world talking to people about the times in their lives when they felt their best and they performed their best. Everywhere he went, people said the same thing. I'm in this altered state of consciousness where every action, every decision I make seems to flow effortlessly, perfectly, seamlessly from the last. Flow actually feels flowy. More specifically, it refers to any of those moments of rapt attention and total absorption. You're so focused on the task at hand, so focused on what you're doing, everything else just seems to disappear. But one of the things that athletes talk about a lot is what they call the voice. Often when I'm skiing in flow, I will get directions, right, left, do this, do that, and it's very quick. You either do what the voice is telling you to do, or you tend to crash. The challenge skills balance is often called the golden rule to flow, and the idea here is pretty simple. We pay the most attention to the task at hand when the challenge of that task slightly exceeds our skill set. So to do this work and to get good at it, you have to get good at being comfortable with being uncomfortable. So you want to stretch, but not snap. So there are a number of different things you can do to sort of prepare yourself and prepare the environment to drop into flow. The flow triggers are your toolkit. 22 of them have been discovered. There are probably way, way more, but so far researchers have identified 22. The most basic of flow's triggers, complete concentration. You really want to sort of start your work session, if you can, in relationship to your physiology. I like to wake up at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. That's when I'm most awake, most alert. I am married to a night owl. My wife doesn't wake up till 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night. That's when her brain comes alive. And then you want to try to block out 90 to 120 minutes for uninterrupted concentration. concentration. Practice distraction management ahead of time. So you want to turn off your phone, turn off email, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, etc. All your messages, all your alerts. There was a study where they found that coders in flow, if they get knocked out by distraction, a knock at the door, a text alert or whatever, it can take them 15 minutes to get back into flow. If they can get back in at all, flow only shows up when all of our attention is in the right here, right now. One way to kind of explore flow triggers is a cluster of them that are predominantly dopamine triggers. They drive focus, they drive attention, they drive alertness and excitement. And there's a lot of different ways to get dopamine. Novelty produces dopamine. We see the same thing with unpredictability, complexity, the experience of awe. You look up at the night sky and you see stars everywhere, and you know those stars are actually universes, and you get sort of perceptual vastness. If you've ever done a crossword puzzle or Sudoku, you get an answer right, that little rush of pleasure you get, that's dopamine. And then you usually get a couple of answers right in a row. That's because the dopamine that is now in your system is amplifying pattern recognition. We get that same dopamine from risk-taking. And this...
Looks like we've inadvertently discovered a dopamine emotional trigger mine here. Huh. Look at that. Epic Journeyman, are you still there? Have you checked the perimeter and not come back?
Oh, here I was talking. I was muted. Yeah, I said all that talk about the flow. You know, it was like Pavlovian. The terms come up again. Yeah.
No, but did you?
I listened to it all though. Yeah, I listened to it all. I didn't hear that last part though.
Did you just hear what he just said about this whole dopamine thing?
Oh, awesome! Yeah.
Now listen. Let's re-listen. We're replaying it, man. We got about 8 minutes left. I just want to replay this real quick. Hang on a second. Here we go. Let's just re-listen to some of this here. Hang on.
In relationship to your physiology, I like to wake up at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. That's when I'm most awake, most alert. I am married to a night owl. My wife doesn't wake up till 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night. That's when her brain comes alive. And then you want to try to block out 90 to 120 minutes for uninterrupted concentration. Practice distraction management ahead of time. So you want to turn off your phone, turn off email, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, etc. All your messages, all your alerts. There was a study where they found that coders in flow, if they get knocked out by distraction, a knock at the door, a text alert or whatever, it can take them 15 minutes to get back into flow. If they can get back in at all, flow only shows up when all of our attention is in the right here, right now. One way to kind of explore flow triggers is a cluster of them that are predominantly dopamine triggers.
Okay. So there's a cluster of triggers that are dopamine triggers. Okay, so let's pay attention to this dopamine discussion here, because this is important, man, because dopamine ties into the internet and your interaction with it.
Drive focus, they drive attention, they drive alertness and excitement. And there's a lot of different ways to get dopamine. Novelty produces dopamine. We see the same thing with unpredictability, complexity, the experience of awe. You look up at the night sky and you see stars everywhere, and you know those stars are actually universes, and you get sort of perceptual vastness.
So awe causes dopamine. Did you know that? When you looked up at the sky and realized not only were they stars, epic journey, but they were universes. Did you get a dopamine jump from that? You didn't realize it, did you?
From all the galaxies? Yeah. Not generally. I did when I went up to Mauna Kea, though, or Mauna Loa. Yeah,
I just mean you being in a state of awe causes dopamine.
Oh, of course.
All right, so what could cause awe on the internet? I mean, can you see some...
Into the microcosm, of course. Come on.
If you've ever done a crossword puzzle or Sudoku, you get an answer right, that little rush of pleasure you get, that's dopamine. And then...
There it is again. That little rush of pleasure you get when you get the answer right on the crossword puzzle.
Usually get a couple of answers right in a row. That's because the dopamine that is now in your system is amplifying pattern recognition. We get that same dopamine from risk-taking. And this could be physical risks, emotional risks, social risks, intellectual risks, possibly spiritual risks.
So the thing is, what I just noticed is what he said was, we get the same dopamine from all those other things. So it doesn't matter what the thing is. What matters is the dopamine. Epic Journeyman. So it doesn't matter what the thing is. All of these things he's describing, everything that he's describing gives you that rush.
The dopamine, not as a reward for taking the risk, which is what some people used to believe, but now we know it's to kind of drive motivation. Now, there are lots of different intrinsic motivators, but from a motivation standpoint, there are five, and they're all designed to be built into one another and work in a sort of specific order, in a specific sequence. The most basic human motivator is curiosity. One of the things we get from curiosity is focus for free. When we're curious about something, we don't have to struggle. We don't have to burn a lot of calories trying to pay attention to it. Curiosity is designed, biologically again, to be built into passion. And think about, we've all fallen in love, how much attention you pay to the person you're falling in love with. You can't stop thinking about them, can't stop staring at them. That's a tremendous amount of focus for free. Now, passion is incredibly useful, but as a motivator, you can go one better, which is purpose. Everybody wants to talk about, oh, I have a purpose, and it's this big altruistic thing, and it's good for the world, and all those things may be true, but from a peak performance perspective, it's very, very selfish. Once you have purpose, the system demands autonomy. I want the freedom to pursue my purpose. And once you have that freedom, the system wants the last of the big motivators, mastery. Mastery is the skills to pursue that purpose well. One of the really...
little black clouds keep walking around with me.
This has been Into the Microcosm. Thank you for being here. Revolution Radio, we'll see you later. YouTube, stay where you are. Independent Network, stay where you are. Revolution Radio, good night. See you next week.
Maybe tomorrow I find my way.
Don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle happens. Epic Journeyman, say goodnight, man. We're out of here.
Good night, man. We're out of here.
I look around at a beautiful life. I've been the upper side of down, been the inside of out. But we breathe. We breathe. I want to breathe in an open mind. I want to swim in the ocean. I want to take my time for me.
Testing. 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 Hello. Waiting for the bumper. Testing. 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 Hello.
Mount Warning, the most easterly point of Australia. Tune in to the Free Manatee Radio Show with your host, Spread Love, every Monday, 6 a.m. EST. On the show each week, we discuss realistic solutions to help you observe rather than take part in the globalist agenda. We will dig into the past to find solutions for the future. We will discuss the wisdom of Ayurveda, the science of life, for techniques for understanding and achieving personal health and longevity. Please join us every Monday on Studio A, 6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, the Free Manatee Radio broadcast with your host, Spread Love, on Revolution Radio. freedomslips.com.
Hello, my name is Mr. Rowe. I am the host of Reality Extraction on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. I utilize logic, intellect, and magic to methodically autonomize, vivisect, analyze, examine, study, scrutinize, and extract an essence of reality from a fog of illusion and confusion. You can find me on Studio B every Thursday at 1700 hours Pacific Time. That's 8 p.m. Eastern. No topic taboo, no subject too strange. I strive to take a neutral standpoint during the dissection of the topic at hand. That's Reality Extraction with Mr. Rowe on Revolution Radio.
Moscow's freeze. That's your cerebral cortex looking for an answer it doesn't have.
See? Even your brain knows you're screwed.
Your brain is filling with adrenaline right now. Whether you know it or not. Your heart's beating fast. It's getting a little louder to breathe. The neurobiological system is telling it to run, but your knees are too weak to move.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. Do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. 100% listener-supported radio. Reporting the danger, unafraid, right here, where information never sleeps. Revolution. Radio!
Late at night and the bars are all closed. Is it time for bed? Hell no, it's time for after hours.
25 years and my life is still trying to get up that great big hill of hope.
Now here's your host
for a destination,
Chair Bear.
I realized quickly when I knew I should that the world was made up of this brotherhood of man. For whatever that means.
Good evening, this is Jer, and I hope I'm coming in. Hope you're doing well. Hello, Comet, did I surprise you? I don't know. I don't know too much tonight. I'm tripping. I'm tripping tonight. Well, hello, everybody. What's going on? Hello, May Street. Hello, Comet. Did I surprise you? Hello. I don't know. Raven. I don't know. Raven.
Too much tonight. I'm tripping tonight.
Anyway, I have the tuner on. I don't know what's going on tonight. I didn't get a hold of anybody to try to ride shotgun tonight. Just kind of been tripping by myself tonight, floating around, checking this, checking that, wondering where I went wrong. But I don't know. I don't know. If anybody wants to come in and join me, the line's open. You know how to get in here. Get some started, play some CODs. Check it out, feel it. I don't know. So I'm just totally spaced cadet tonight. Why? Just that way. I got something to play here about Gene Simmons. The 70-year-old demon documentary, Kiss Gene Simmons. I might go with that. I don't know. I don't know where my head is. It's attached to my brain. I mean, it's attached to my neck. Honest. I was checking out what's his name? Eddie Van Halen. And some stories pretty trippy about Eddie Van Halen and just stories about other people that knew him. pretty interesting shit. And what else? I just don't know. I ain't happening. I should be happening. But I got Comet calling in. Let's see. Hello, where are you at? I don't see you. I pulled you in here, but I don't see you. Comet, where you at? Oh, shit. Not again. Hey, participants. Two Feathers is not on the call. Did he call? I thought it was Comet calling in. Shit. I don't know. Comet, Two Feathers, did you call in? Somebody want to call in? The lines are open. You guys know. Two Feathers is trying to come in here. There he is. Hey, Two Feathers.
What's up, Jeff Bear?
You tell me, we'll both know.
Well, I just wanted to know that you hear from your nephew, Jason.
No, I haven't tried to touch base with him. I have not touched base with him.
Oh, because I heard they had a shelling in Kiev.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was just wondering if, you know, maybe he reached out to you yet. And
I don't know if he's, I could just try to drag him in here and see if he'll join without asking him. I don't know if he'll show up. I don't know. You know what I'm saying? I don't know. What's that?
No, I was just curious if he might have reached out to you, saw something.
It's like his own world, and I really haven't. I've been in my own world as well, and when you're in different worlds, you space out, touching base, and like tonight, I just been floating around and I didn't know what I was going to do tonight. And I'm on the fly all the time. And usually that's the best way to be. But what's new in your neighborhood? Hi, Comet. What's new in your neighborhood, Two Feathers?
Oh, not much. It's the other night I sit out on the highway for 7 hours.
Due to what?
Had a flat tire on the trailer.
What caused it?
Oh, I don't know. A weak tire.
So who fixed it?
Someone from the Baton Rouge, Louisiana area.
What, was he just a stranger jumping in to help you? Or?
No, it was a third party.
Or part of the company.
Yeah, it was a company, a guy. Well, third party company, you know.
Oh, so he's affiliated with your company and just came out and helped you out.
Yeah, he's affiliated with the roadside company.
So did you have to? Does he get paid for that?
Yeah, definitely.
He's under contract then, I guess.
Yeah, exactly, and. But the thing was, I was an hour and a half away from where he was coming from.
And?
I was on the highway 5 hours before he even got in touch with me.
Why was that?
Because the roadside service that we used couldn't get in touch with anyone.
Well, that's messed up.
Yes, it is.
So somebody broke the line of command or something and caused you to, what, were you on your way home?
Yeah, I was on my way back. And what happened is he said that these youngsters out here, you know, he gets paid like $30, $35 an hour. Well, you get these youngsters, they don't want to work for no $15, $16 an hour, you know, killing their backs. In the area I was in, there was no tire center open, you know.
There was no what?
No tire center.
So would they do have to bring you a new tire or at a frame, or what was the story?
Yeah, they had to bring me a new tire coming from the Baton Rouge, Louisiana area.
Well, did that have a rim on it, or do you have to play Mr. Tire Replacement, new tire on the rim?
Well, the hour and a half that I was away from where he was at, he actually had to come another close to an hour to get to the hour and a half that it bus, he had to go get the tire. So that's why all that time took time, you know?
So does that stop you from getting paid even though you were held up all the time?
I get like 7 hours, downtime.
So you get paid for the downtime?
Yeah, separate from my regular pay.
And it's all, and who confirms that? The tire mechanic?
Oh, no. My supervisor's at the office.
Well, you have to sign something when he fixes the truck to get his on. And I imagine.
No, I didn't have to sign anything.
You just, how long did it take him once he got to the job?
Took him about maybe 45 minutes to an hour.
So does his rig have, does his rig have it where he takes off your tire, puts it on his rig and strips the broken tire off the rig's rim and puts the new tire on the rim, existing rim, and put it back on the truck?
Yeah, it's called two tire tools.
Well, so when you go buy tires, they have to take off the old rim. They take off the old tire from the rim. So that he's got that rig all set up to do that is what I'm asking him.
Yeah, well, he's got the compressor on his service truck, but that's all. But it didn't have the strip. He had to strip the rim off the other tire to put on a new tire, you know?
So he has the tire, he has the thing to take it off a rim and replace it with a new tire on his rig.
It's like two big crowbars or something, right?
I'm just asking a simple question.
Yeah, I'm giving you a simple answer.
So his rig is probably a tow truck too. He can tow a diesel with that sucker, his truck. Is that right?
Negative.
Okay, negative this. So are you home now relaxing?
Negative. I'm on my way home.
And so you're delayed from getting home how many hours?
Oh, that was the other night. Tonight I'm okay. Last night I was able to make they gave me a shorter route. I got to run like a shorter distance, you know, because I met the guy because I hadn't been on the road for so long.
I thought this all was tonight, all this drama.
Tonight was okay. I mean, I had to do my regular run to go meet the guy. But last night or the other night, I got to go like a shorter distance to meet him. And then two nights ago is when that happened. I broke down outside my room.
I got you.
Yeah.
Comment, what's up with you, Comment? Nice to see you.
Hey, how you doing, Comment?
Good morning. Yeah, I'm all right. Good morning, Two Feathers and Jer Bear. I'm all right, Jer.
got up a little early tonight and listened to the Microcosm finished up. Then the whole thing went dead for about an hour. So I got on and experimented a little bit with the Nest and played a couple of things. I had got permission to do that, but part of the deal I have access to, but my password, or I don't have the password to go in and turn off the Nest and restart it. So like if it's dead air, I can go in there and put something on or restart something. And I don't have complete access to that yet. So, but since it was dead, I was able to go in there and play something while it was dead. I just couldn't restart something to.
So you're talking about in Hawk's Nest.
Yeah, in the Hawk's Nest, just a place.
It was dead, and you had the chance to play what you wanted.
Yeah, a place for me to practice, you know, in case I might end up getting an hour later on if I feel like I'm you know, doing any good. But right now I'm just kind of playing with the Nest and when it's dead, you know, and I've got something to play. I was thinking, you know, because everybody's always posting stuff in the chat, and some of it's really, really good, but half the people probably never watch it. So I was thinking about, you know, since the Nest is there, that, and I'm sitting here, I might sit there in the Nest and just, as people put stuff in the chat, I could play it over the Nest. And then if people wanted to see what was in that video, they wouldn't have to open it and shut down and everything. They could just listen through the Nest. But that's just something that I might do, you know, in dead air times.
I don't think I have the permission to go jump into the Nest. I don't know. I can't remember if I.
Yeah, well, I got on with Painter the other morning, and we talked for a couple of hours, and he gave me permission to do all that. I've actually got access to all the stuff now, except I have to have a password to shut the Nest down and start something. And Mr. Rowe got me in there the other day so I could do that, but he didn't give me the password. Now, you know, I can understand why, because it's probably linked to a lot of stuff. So in order for me to get back in there, he has to let me in because I don't have the password. Even though I've got the program downloaded and all the information in there, I still have to have someone.
Well, you should ask him if the password's accessible, so you don't have to freak him out late in the night to do things.
Yeah,
ask Painter. I would ask Painter.
Well, I don't. Painter's the one that we started with, and he told me to go to Roe because Roe knew more about it. So I did, and Roe got me in there. But he didn't give me he didn't give me the code so I could get back in there. He told me to leave it open, and I did for that day. But you know, I shut my computer down pretty regularly, or I don't really shut it down, but I clean it out because it memory fills up, and I have to clear it all out so I can keep going. And when I did it, I had to shut that down, so I have to have him to get back in it. But you know, it's no big deal. I'm just trying to do what I can to help. I'm not seeking any kind of notoriety or nothing like that. I don't like to see dead air. So since I'm here, you know, if it's not any trouble, any problem, then that's what I'll do. I'll just jump on it.
You ain't trying to be like me and get some notoriety.
I don't want nobody to know who I am, man. Because when people figure out who you are, they start throwing rocks at you.
Well, as long as those rocks, as long as you are skilled enough to dodge them and throw rocks, ain't no shit about it.
Yeah, I don't like dodging rocks.
Ask Two Feathers. He's been in the mix before.
Two Feathers has been here a while, man. He comes in all the time and makes sure that the air is full. I appreciate everything he does. Bless you there, Two Feathers, working that ass off every day.
I try. I'm like you. I hope they don't hate the messenger. I just try to bring a good message and try to fill dead air, just like yourself. I'm trying to do what I can to make the world a better place to be.
Yeah, I always love to hear you on there, Two Feathers. You, you got a really good attitude and a really good outlook on things, and you know, we've got all kinds. We've got the doom and gloomers, and I think I may fit in all of those categories because it depends on what time of day it is to what what category I fall in. But you know, we all experience all these things together, you know. And when you've got someone to discuss it with, it really helps you work through these things.
It does. It does. To it does.
Just being able to talk about it and get it out, you know, because when you hold stuff in, and I've tried that before too, and that was one of my problems for a long time, is I don't like conflict because I have a hard time controlling myself when I'm confronted with conflict. So I avoid it as much as I can, which means
Dad, what are you doing?
Huh?
Fall down?
Oh.
No, I didn't. I'm good.
Oh yeah, I heard a bang, crash, boom.
Oh, yeah, that might have been me. I was wiping my screen off. Maybe I bumped the mic on my computer.
Hey, at least you weren't wiping your rear end.
No, I was wiping the screen off. It was dusty.
I'm just joking. Two Feathers, how's your boy doing that got in a little trouble sometime back in school?
He's good. Tomorrow we bring him to a program. It's called YCP. That's a youth challenge program. Represents him getting his GED because the damn school wasn't teaching him, man.
You're breaking up.
And
Damn, you're breaking up, sucker.
How do I sound right now? I can hear you.
What you ought to do is drop it, come right back in. I think you'll sound better.
I sure will.
Hold on. That's my suggestion.
If he's driving, he might be in a dead spot.
I don't know what he's doing, except Bill doing.
You know, some of them highways down in South Louisiana, some of them have power lines running down beside of them, and that'll interfere with your signal. And some of them are out in the middle of nowhere.
I didn't know if he was working right now.
Oh, I don't know. I assumed he was. He usually is.
You never assume. It makes an ass out of you and me.
I know. And I tend to do that too much.
I've got... I thought, yeah, maybe I have to bring him in now. I don't know. I just don't know. Got to call him back in here because he should have been back by now. Hey, what am I going to do? Hey, what's he going to do? Hello, everybody. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslip.com. You're listening to Listener Supported. Comment, are we in our 12th year or our 13th year? I have no clue.
We are in the 12th year. I believe either December 31st or January the 1st of 2011,
It was January 1st, 2011.
Yeah, January 1st, 2011, so that would make us in the 12th year. And see, I came in like either the end of March or the beginning of April that year. So right now is April, so I'm kind of celebrating my 12th anniversary around this time, because I was they were here for 3 months when I came, and I accidentally came here because you remember Carrie Cassidy? I was listening to one of her videos on YouTube, and it said in there that she was on Revolution Radio, and back then I was just, you know, getting into her stuff. I mean, I'd listened to a lot of documentaries.
I had a lot of fun with Carrie Cassidy. The guy that died, that lived up there in Massachusetts. I can't think of his name.
Her sidekick?
No. He lived with his wife and then he passed away. Couldn't see no more. But back then, me and him were on Skype laughing and listening to Kerry Cassidy get drove by this old dude. And this old dude drove her like an 18-wheeler. And it was just funny. It was funny.
Anyway, yeah, that's how I got here. I followed it. She said that she was on Revolution Radio. So I clicked on it and boom, Revolution Radio popped up and I've been here ever since.
I swear. Well, I'm trying to find two fellas.
I swear.
Who said that? I swear. I'm going to try to bring in.
He found you there, Jer.
I'm going to try to bring Mario in. He's green. And this other guy from, see if they can join us. Mario, boy, he can drive people like an 18-wheeler and cap on you.
He likes Don't to bring cap in Mario. He'll cap on me, man.
Well, I'll get him if he does. We can gang up on him. He's green in Skype, and I asked Brian to come in too, but they're not answering. And if Big Warren's out there, to hear from him too.
Well, if he's like me, he falls asleep and leaves all that stuff on, you know.
Well, we all do, but I gave it a try. Mario, come and join us, Sir Mario. He's a pretty wild guy. He's got two shows, Monday and I think Friday. And once in a while, I'm up to catch him and. He'll see me in the chat room and start in.
Yesterday morning, or was it day before yesterday morning, I fell asleep with everything on early, you know, and both of my space phones in the house were dead, and my sister was trying to call me to come have coffee that morning, and of course I couldn't hear the phones because they were both dead, and they come banging on my door, man. I was asleep. And when they banged on my door, I bet you I jumped about a foot up in the bed. I was like, what? I was just dead asleep. I didn't know. I felt like something blew up.
Back in, I can't remember the exact year, but when the PepCon explosion happened in Henderson, I just got home and I laid down on the couch and, My apartment window faced south, and that's where the PepCon was, like 25 miles away, and it blew up. And all of a sudden, I woke up, and I sounded like somebody banged my window, like bam. I got up. What the hell was that? And then I just didn't know what it was. I fell back asleep, and a few minutes, not even much time later. Bam! And when I had the window curtain open, and I looked, and I could just see this big mushroom cloud where the PepCon was happening. And I go, damn! One of my best friends was helping in that. He died. He died a couple months ago. A little longer than that, my buddy Martin Santacor. Gosh. And I know him since he was 21, and he was out there helping with the emergency. I caught him on video, and I sent it to him before he passed away. So now look, Mark, gosh, we have changed so much. Well, I have, you know, we've all changed so much in looks since those early days when we were 21 and, you know, in our 20s when I was the wild child. But anyway, gosh, I think about. Always when I'm in the kitchen, I'm doing something, I think about my past. That's like it's like my little room where just I recall things and wonder about people, and I should have a little piece of paper in there and write it down and then come try to look for them. A couple guys from the Showboat Brothers I wanted to look up. And it's a trip. I don't know if you guys have moments where you got a place. Usually I do it when I'm in the kitchen and it's tying me up and I'm using my head but I'm thinking about, that's where I think about a lot of shit, put it that way. Should I do this? Should I do that?
You know what, Jeff? I don't have to really be in a special place for that. That is a constant thing that goes on in my head. I was talking to Painter the other day. I said, you know, I spend a lot of time in my own head evaluating every freaking thing. And a lot of times, even when I'm talking to somebody, there's something else going on in my head. And I may hear what they're saying, and I may comprehend it, and I may not, because I have a hard time stopping that mechanism that's constantly going back there, and I can't stop it. It's good or bad. It's just a constant thing that goes on in the back of my head that I can't stop.
I can get that way doing my show, that I'm be thinking about something that'll throw me off, and I'll say, hey, what'd you say? I wasn't quite listening. But, am I coming in pretty good tonight? Am I clear? My mic?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you sound great.
Okay. So do you both. I was wondering if Sergeant Miller, he's not green. I was going to bring him in, too. He turned me on a couple videos to get something going, and if I go look at it, I'll get lost unless you guys say something in our chat here to get me back in, because I usually get lost.
No problem.
Let me see. Comment. Sergeant Miller. Okay. Well, you guys can say hello if I need you to get back in this, because if I can't get back in, sometimes I can't. Okay. All right.
I've already got it typed in. All I got to do is click it, Bear, if you get lost.
Okay, let me go see what Sergeant Miller put in there. It's something about Mafia Underboss. Hold on. And then he's got something else. I got to click one more time. Let's see. All right. So now it's been there. I'll suckle up, Jared. Hold on. Now let me try to get back into the call. Okay. Can you guys hear me?
Yep.
I hear you.
Oh, shit. I think you guys got... See, it's weird. I'm not in the... You guys got to send me a message, because I'm not in it right.
Go ahead, Tom.
Just put hi.
Yeah, I put hello in there twice.
I don't see nothing.
I did. I sent it twice. Here, let me do it again.
Just stay high and so I can see the chat. I don't see it.
I posted three times. Hello, hello, hello.
Damn it. See? I messed up.
I see two feathers. Two feathers is in there.
I'm not in there. I can't. If I don't get see the message, Sergeant Miller always used to help me get back in there.
Okay, let me go try to...
I don't know what to do. If you guys can't... Let's see. Maybe this
I sent you a message.
Hey, now I'm back in there. Okay. Thank you. So I'm back in there. Okay, yeah, I see that. I don't know why I finally... Two feathers that showed up. It didn't show up with you, comment.
You might have me on don't pay attention to this.
I don't know. I'm not... I'm just saying, okay, all right, let's... I don't know what to say. I should say, just shut up. Let me see now. I don't know.
That's weird. You don't see mine? Do you see mine, Feathers?
I seen it now, but I didn't hear it or see it when you did it.
Oh,
when
okay.
Two Feathers said it. I found it.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why. I don't have no answers. It's not. Tell me if you guys hear this. It's called Mafia Underboss. Sammy Gravano breaks silence. This is something. Or discussing mafia business. let me see what, you know, this town is a lot of mafia in this town back in the day of Vegas.
That's a two hours and 30 minute video.
Well, I'm just going to see what it's saying.
Okay. Not...
Tell me if you hear it.
It's not playing anything yet. Okay. Wait. Nope. Wait, it's not making no, nope. No, I don't hear nothing.
You don't hear it?
Nope.
See, I see some, now I got to reshare. It's always something. Got to save it out something. Stop sharing. Now I'll share again. Sucker wolves.
Put on your glasses.
I don't need them yet. I can see good. So now tell me, if you guys hear it, don't say nothing. If you don't hear it, if you hear it, stay silent. Okay, sharing. Da, da, da. Gonna have a good time. Who sang that song? Yeah, yeah. Was that Rerun? It's a show with Rerun in it. Good time. No, that was the other. That was the other. I liked Good Times. I liked Rerun. And who else? And that other show I just, you know, the guy, the tall, skinny guy that was in his show, that was Good Times.
Yeah.
He used to bowl at the hotel I worked at. I used to get off work and walk through the bowling alley home. And I'd see that skinny dude. What was his name in that show with the old mama and the papa died?
That was good time.
Yeah, I knew you would know, brother. But what was that tall dude's name? He used to bowl by himself.
That was Jimmy Walker.
Yeah, that's him. That's him, I swear.
Yeah, they called him JJ.
JJ. He was always getting in trouble, wasn't he?
I mean, he was cool, you know. He was a cool dude.
But didn't he always get in trouble and Mama have to get on his ass?
Yeah.
Okay.
But his Mama, he always loved his Mama, though, you know.
Well, we all do, don't we?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Right. I liked that show, though. It had some drama in it, and his little sister was pretty good looking.
Yeah, she was.
She was a fox. What happened to all the Cosby kids? They're grown up and they're just throwing ass at Bill Cosby for... I got a story about Bill Cosby. When he was working at the Hilton, my friend Charles Lee, he was a brother that I worked with, honestly. He's still alive. I've been wanting to call him. Charles Lee said, yeah, Jerry, we had to do something. Somehow we had to go up to the Hilton, the penthouse where Bill Cosby was, and we helped him do something. And he offered us a drink. And Charles said, yeah, I like some of that Martell up there up on the shelf. He goes, no, you can't have that. I'll give you a bottle of beer or something. But he wouldn't let Charles have the hard shit. Those guys grew up on cognac, and when we used to have our Super Bowl parties, everybody brought a half pint. I usually brought some Jim Beam, and they all had Cavassier and Martell, and gosh, we used to have some fun at those Super Bowl parties. I'd bring a keg of beer too, a little pony keg, 7 gallons.
Yeah.
I'd get it cheap and bring it in. We'd sit in the garage and watch the Super Bowl or a few places or other houses. God, the brothers were so cool. I love them. And they'd throw a dollar out. I get he don't do it. Catch a pass or there's an interception. They'd have a little kitty going to see who would win that little throwing a couple of dollars in the kitty as you're watching the game. Boy, I'm about to go back to at least 1987, 86, when the Chicago played. They had the fridge. Remember the refrigerator?
Yeah, yeah.
That's when Chicago was bad, the Bears. I'll swear. What's a good story you remember that I could just make your mind flash to your two feathers? Got any stories?
Who's that, Sucker Wolf?
Say again?
I say, who you talking?
I said two feathers. I didn't say flock of feathers this time. I didn't mean to get you mixed up.
No, I thought you meant Comet. Comet could probably tell you some stories.
I'm asking you. I'm talking to you. Why are you going to run away now? I don't know, Chair. I'm just thinking here. Don't pick on me. I'm not going
to
pick on
you. I'll tell you something that happened to me last night that was kind of funky. My brother-in-law stopped it at the Subway up there to get me a meatball sandwich. Meatball sandwich, and you just put meatballs and on it. And so my nephew goes in there and gets it, and he comes, he brings me a sandwich, it's got lettuce and everything else all on it, just totally all messed up. Anybody know what I'm talking about? The meatball sandwich, you don't put lettuce on.
Hold on, say that slow. You did something to it, what?
He went and got me a meatball sandwich and put lettuce all over it. And you're not supposed to do that. And it was kind of nasty.
I would say, well, two feathers took off. I must have pissed him off. Well, it didn't say shit.
He might be having a signal problem. You got to remember, he's driving.
I didn't know that. But
yeah, he's at work.
I remember when I used to go buy a, I'd be bowling and we'd stop at this one place, still there, Boston Pizza, and we'd get the cheese steak deluxe, and it had the cheese and onions and peppers and all sauteed up and the meat, and if you got the deluxe, they put the lettuce and tomato on. And I haven't had one of those. I don't even know if they still got it, but it was good. It was good like that. It was good. I didn't. I used to freak out on lettuce too, but it helped my digestive system. But I don't know. But I did. I liked them.
Well, lettuce is good for you. You know, it's got fiber. It's not bad eating, but it just don't go with a meatball sandwich. You know.
I'm comparing it to a cheesesteak with it on there, but. I know I dug it as a cheesesteak with that shredded lettuce and more combo deluxe. Two feathers took off on me. Sucker Wolf. I'm going to get him. I'm rowdy tonight. I feel rowdy. I don't care. I ain't never been rowdy on live TV, have I? I mean,
okay. Live. Get rowdy. Okay, this is Rowdy Bear.
Rowdy, what was that guy's, that wrestler named Rowdy what?
Oh man, you
there was a wrestler named Rowdy something. Rowdy.
I know I've heard the name before, but I couldn't tell you because I don't watch it. And
I know, but Rowdy, I'm just flat. My mind's flashing.
And I've heard. I know who you're talking about. I think.
Hey, Alien Girl sent me a nice little care package about a week ago, and there's cool. There's this pipe in it, and I couldn't figure it out. But it's a bomb. But it's just got the. It's two pieces, and you stick the stem. The pipe into the top of it, and then you screw it into a bottle, with some water, and then when you load it up, it'll bong through. It's a bong for water. But I don't have any bottles to try to check that out.
Well, put you some ice in your water, man.
Oh, well, I never liked bombs, but I said, what is that? And I had to figure it out. But
if you're going to use a water bomb, put some ice in there. It cool that smoke off for you.
I always would put too much to choke the shit out of myself. That's why I never liked bombs. That's why I still roll joints to this day.
Me too, and the reason for that is I can control the intake a lot easier.
Well, yeah, you know, take a couple big hits and then let it down for a moment.
Every time I try to use a bong, man, I end up coughing for about 30 minutes straight.
And I don't dig it, but it does get you stoned.
Yeah.
So I'm not near that for me, but I'll just ask. Somebody messaged me somewhere. Anyway, gosh, I don't know what
you got beat.
No, I was testing to see if you guys could hear this.
The good, the bad, and certainly the ugly. In my time, in the heydays.
Did you hear that?
Yeah, buddy.
Nice and clear?
Yep.
I was going to play this, or I was going to play something about Van Halen. And let me find it. I was going to play something like Van Halen. For some reason, last few days, I've been tripping with about Van Halen. But here's the 70-year-old. Let's play this one. This is about.
You've got it muted. You've got the video muted.
I did what?
You have the video muted on YouTube.
I know. I haven't played it yet. I'm trying to copy.
Okay, when you hit play, it's going to be muted, though. Just wanted you to know.
I see that, but.
Okay.
Will you let me? I was trying to copy it and share it with the chat room first.
Okay.
You're trying to be producer too quick on me. Slow down. We'll get copy this clean link. All right. Put it in the chat room. Hello. Hello, chat room. Sergeant Miller.
Two Feathers wrote you a note. It says,
Just a minute, please.
Okay.
Daryl, gosh. Now, go ahead. What you got to say?
You was wondering what that beep was. That was Two Feathers telling you he'll be back. He had to go inside.
Okay. All right. You hear that?
Yep.
Well, this is, I didn't hear it. This is called the 70-year-old demon documentary, Kiss, Gene Simmons, U.S. version. What I was going to say is Gene Simmons is the one that got Van Halen where they was their start off. But anyway, I don't want it to play too much music or that I'm not into that hard sound that you're hearing. Here we go. In Chinese.
So this and you do and it, you do much, it faster. Much faster. So. And you're 100 on the side. Your heart
will go.
Yeah.
And you have to do that because on tour, I'm wearing about 40 pounds of studs and armor, and you can get really tired. Especially at 70.
Well, this is an interview about any 70.
Stand up, you do not to be free. Get down, that's like a hurricane. Sleep boy, going there to physically. Better believe it. Ooh. Future, see the proof of intimacy. Wind blast. Heavy man relaxed in. Rocked on, I want to be the first here. I love you. Hey, hey, yeah!
The easiest it is in the beginning. And the older you get and the longer your career, the harder it is.
Hey, hey, yeah!
Life, every day, is a struggle.
We're quitting because we're going to stop at the top.
Get him, Gene. W.
I
He's walking in Tokyo somewhere. It's still
we had a point of view about going to a smaller place because the smaller cities, the people there have to get into cars and trains and travel a long time. You have to respect the fans who made your life. Without the fans, we're nothing. We're nothing and nobody.
I thought you were doing two ones. Is that all right?
Okay. Showing a big auditorium in China.
Main, main.
I don't know about this.
Eight, right, plan, 1, 2, 3, 4.
This is the smallest hall we've played maybe ever.
It's very small. Yep.
I mean, maybe 3,000 to 4,000 people.
4,000, I think.
Oh, the atmosphere affects us.
Oh, we'll rock it. We'll rock it out.
Okay, ready? You ready?
Oh, gee, do something. Shit. I don't know about this. Anyway, two fellas show up. I don't know. I got something. I think. Jared, chill out. I don't know how sometimes. I don't know.
Everybody, welcome back to Final Resonance TV in episode number 20 of Van Halen Stories. Yeah, today my guest is the incredible Phil X from Bon Jovi and the Drills. You say Phil X and the Drills or the Drills?
I prefer Phil X and the Drills. Okay. But I know it sounds like, here's Phil X from Phil X and the Drills. Or, hey, this is Phil X from Phil X, the Phil X from Phil X and the Drills.
Right, right. So the Bon Jovi thing, you've been there 11 years, is that right?
Holy smokes. Yeah, well, there was a break. I covered for Richie in 2011, and then he came back. And then in 2013 again, and then he didn't come back. So I've been there since 2013, so 9 years.
Yeah, and I heard your first show was 50,000 people.
I mean, you know, and it's funny because a lot of people ask if I was nervous, and I feel like, you know, it seems like you know, it's a do or die kind of, what's the way they say it? Fight or flight.
Right.
I wasn't nervous because I didn't have time to be nervous. I walked on stage and I said, dude, you've been playing this. You've been playing and singing your whole life. It's just Bon Jovi songs. You got this. And then that's when I just got on stage and delivered. And it's funny because it could have gone... It could have gone bad and I would have got sent home. But I did that show and then I did another 12 shows, I think. And then
one where we went on, we gave a studio tour earlier. We'll put that in this interview. But phone 2 weeks ago and you said, I've got some information, a cool talking point about Bill Church. Now, can you explain who Bill Church was?
Bill Church is a bass player who was mixed into the Van Halen brew as the stew was being put together. A lot of accidental stuff from the beginning. He was a bass player in a group called Sawbuck, and Ronnie Montrose was the guitar player in that group, and they had a front man named Mojo Collins, pretty cool name.
Yeah.
I don't know whatever happened to him, but I heard a couple of Sawbuck things. It didn't have the Montrose touch at all. He was just a guitar player there. And he and Church quit to play on Tupelo Honey record with Van Morrison.
Produced by Ted Templeman.
I think that because Sawbuck was in Marin County, that Van had met Ronnie or seen him.
Yeah.
I think that's how it happened. And Ted did a very good job producing that record. But I have to give equal time to Ronnie Montrose, because the guitar playing on that and the arranging, a lot of it was from Ronnie.
Wow.
I wasn't there, but I remember hearing Church talk about it when I met Church. And Bill Church, bass players never get what they should get.
Recognition.
But a great bass player makes a band better, and people don't realize it.
What?
Just as John Paul Jones and Led Zeppelin. Listen to the bass on what is and should never be. That is a bass part you can't equal.
Yeah.
And Church was a guy who, in a subtle, very American way, would do that with anything he played. Listen to Tupelo Honey. Listen to the bass. St. Dominic's Preview record, he's on that with Van, too.
Which you're on.
Although I was on, Ronnie had left to go to play with Edgar Winter, where they did Frankenstein and Free Ride, two big hits. And then Church rejoined Ronnie when they formed Montrose. And Montrose was the model for Eddie Van Halen. That he had, that band was what Eddie wanted to have for him, for his own band with his brother. And so I'm going to explain a little more about Church. But if you listen to Church on St. Dominic's Preview, take a song. There's a little almost Vegas-like song on there called I Will Be There. Listen to the bass line in that thing. It's a little jazz song. It had been written as a triadic thing. Van had written it on a piano.
Yeah.
And I said, Van, I had heard it once up at his little studio he was putting together, up at the house at 89 Spring Lane, which Jerry Heller got wrong in his book. But we
Jerry
can talk
Heller
about
that,
too. Jerry Heller had something to do with Van Morrison. I'll tell you in a minute.
Wow.
I knew him very well. And
famous NWA producer, but he also produced rock and roll mainstream pop artists, too, back in the day.
He was a very bright man. Nice guy to be around, and tough as tough can be. When he had to be.
I'd imagine if he was managing NWA.
Yes, he was.
But continue, please. With the...
So in any event, go and listen just as an example to I Will Be There and listen to the bass line. It's a very melodic bass line that you might almost attribute to Paul McCartney, because McCartney was a bass player who didn't just play the roots at the right moments. He played lines that were in themselves melodic and good, and Church can do that too. And on that song, Church didn't do what most, if we had had Leroy Vinegar or Ron Carter, one of the top jazz bass players, they would not have done I Will Be There as well as Bill Church did. They would have done walking bass lines, and that would have been it. But Church knew what to do. So anyway, move ahead to Montrose. Montrose is the model for Eddie Van Halen in his head when he's a kid, just trying to think about what he wants to do. And I think I'll jump to the end on that for a second here.
Well, it's a cool talking point, though. It was your amplifier, your Marshall.
That's what I'm about to talk about.
Lead, which is, I think we might have discussed it on the other one, because it's, oh, Doug, someone's calling you. Is it Bill Church? But that's your Marshall that Ronnie Montrose is playing on Rock Candy, which is recorded here at Sunset Sound.
But in reading Ted's book, Ted Templeman's book recently, I saw that Eddie had, when they got to the point of doing the first Van Halen album, Eddie had asked Ted, and it's in Ted's book, could we get the amp that Ronnie Montrose used on Rock Candy? Little did they figure out that it was my Marshall that I had lent to the Montrose Project through Steve Brandon, who was our roadie with Van Morrison and had been one of the guys who built the Grateful Dead monster PA system, the first monster system ever. And Steve Brandon had called me from Sunset Sound to say, we're down here with Ronnie. I knew Ronnie. I had met him a few times. I have a pretty salty story about him. I don't know if I should tell it.
Sure. Wyatt.
Well,
documenting.
When I met Ronnie, Bill Church and I got along great. When I joined Van, he was the nicest guy in the band. The first day I was there, he invited me to come up to his house, and he cooked dinner for me. Church is a great guy, and he lived up in Sonoma County, if I remember, near Santa Rosa.
Is this the one with Ronnie's wife?
Yeah. You want to hear it?
Yeah, I mean, I know what you're saying, but go. I don't know if anyone else knows.
Church called me one day, and he said, I told him that I really liked the guitar parts on Like a Cannonball and Wild Nights and the things that Ronnie had done for Van. And he said, well, let's go see Ronnie. And he lived in Fairfax, too, up near Van's place. Van was at 89 Spring Lane. And we went to see Ronnie, and he was about to go on the road with Edgar Winter. And at one point, Ronnie turned to me and Church. He says, you know, when I'm gone, I don't want my wife screwing around with strangers. So if you guys want to partake, go ahead. I couldn't believe it. I said, Montrose, you're nuts. Of course, Church and I wouldn't do that.
Oh, my.
Ronnie offered his wife as if he had the right to, which he didn't, you know. Ronnie was a character.
Yeah, so, I'm sure he was kidding.
So what happened next with Church, says he was with Van Morrison. We did St. Dominic's Preview. He played on 5 of the 7 songs. 2 songs were really from the Tupelo Honey sessions.
Yeah.
Almost Independence Day and Listen to the Lion. They were already done before we did the rest of the record. At some point, if you want to know how say Jackie Wilson Said was put together, I can explain.
We'll talk about some Van stuff.
Yeah.
Later.
So anyway, Church was there. Ronnie was off with Edgar Winter, and then Church. They did the Montrose record, Sammy Hagar as the lead singer, and
a lot of people don't know. I mean, if you're a fan of Montrose or Van Halen, but Sammy Hagar was in Montrose.
Yes, he was the lead singer.
Yes, and Montrose was on Warner Brothers. Ted Templeman produced them.
Yes,
and they had success. Nothing like Van Halen, but when Ted Templeman got to Van Halen, he knew exactly what he wanted to do with them because they were similar
to
Montrose.
That's good.
And he wanted to get them in singles territory, Van Halen.
Agreed. That's a great point.
Yes.
And Montrose, on the Montrose record, there were some great songs. But Rock Candy is the one that everybody talks about because of 2 things, the drum sound and the guitar sound. And in Ted's book, he mentions that Eddie asked him, can we get that amp? Well, apparently Ted forgot how they had gotten that amp through Steve Brandon, you know, who was a friend of Church's, and I guess he knew Ronnie too. He was a Bay Area guy. And little did they know that I was my Marshall. I didn't get to use it a lot in the early days of the 70s because the bands out here weren't into Marshalls yet. You know, smaller amps, clubs, and stuff like that. But later on, after Van Halen was well known, I sold that Marshall to guess whom? Eddie Van Halen.
I didn't know that. We didn't discuss that last time.
No,
So Eddie Van Halen owned the 100?
The 100 watt amp. He didn't even know it, and I didn't even mention it because I didn't know that Ted had asked Ted, could you find that amp? I found that out recently, a few weeks ago, when I was reading Ted's book.
That
Eddie had said, hey, Ted, could we get that? I'd like to hear that amp. Not, this is before Eddie knew that his amp was amazing. His amp was we know
so
it.
So he's a Montrose fan. He wants that sound on Rock Candy, the amp from that, which was your amp. They couldn't find you. Ted didn't remember, but hold on one second. Ted wanted to find you, couldn't. So then where did they get an amp? They just used Eddie's?
Ted didn't try to find me. He didn't even know where it had come from. And I just learned this a few weeks ago, but I said, my God, that's the amp that I sold to Eddie somewhere after they did Fair Warning.
Oh, so
he bought an amp from me. And I remember running into him one day at the supermarket. I told you that story. And I said, how do you like my Marshall? He says, it's a little too clean for me.
Did he come buy it from you personally, or was there a middleman?
They came to my apartment.
Okay.
In those days,
like 83, kind of maybe 82,
somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And he came to my apartment, 7934 Fountain Avenue.
He wanted to track down that amp. So he was, even when he was in here in 77, 78.
No, but he didn't know that had been the amp on Rock Candy, and I never mentioned it to him.
Why did he buy your amp then?
Because I had told him, I have a Marshall that I'm not using right now. Do you want it?
Oh, my gosh. So then it happened to be the one he wanted anyway.
It just happened to be the one that had been used on Rock Candy.
That's the universe.
Now, the story I heard about the recording of Rock Candy right here in this room, I think. No, it was in one.
Oh, Greg Renoff. Greg Renoff, the famous Ted Templeman author, we had a bet, and I said it was Studio 2 because you told me it was Studio 2, but now Greg said you're wrong. It's Studio 1 that Rock Candy was done in.
It might have been Rock Candy. I think some of the rest of it was done here, but Candy was done there. And the story that I heard was that Ted and Landy didn't know what to do with an amp that's that loud, right? People hadn't played them. People had super reverbs and twins and occasionally a small Marshall. And what they did, this is the story I heard, they aimed the amp at the glass door that's at the back of the room, of the main room. They aimed the amp at it from about maybe where this far from that door. And then they put a microphone, a tube mic, and I think they told him, I don't remember who told me this, so this could be all apocryphal. This could be crap. But I think it's true, because it sounds right. They put a tube mic behind the cabinet, and it was what you hear on the record is the amp bouncing back off the glass.
Wow.
They didn't put a mic right in front of it. Most condenser mics don't work well right up against a Marshall. You need an SM57 or a 421 Sennheiser. That'll do it, you know, or an SM7. But in any case, when I hear that record, I can hear that there's a room to it. And I believe that the story is true, that the mic was behind the amp, behind the cabinet, getting the guitar off the wall.
Wow, we need to go try that.
Yeah, you should. Get a good Marshall, but it has to be an old one.
Yeah.
It doesn't have a preamp. The difference between the Marshalls today and then is that I think they've reissued the ones with no, where you don't have you can't drive the front end. Because that's getting you some more distortion, whereas the way those old Marshalls worked, it was the tail end of the amp that took the beating and the speakers. And that's why they were so loud, just to get that to happen. It has to be maximum power. Not, they don't dime it. They don't take it to 10. But you can get from 5 up. Those old Marshalls are loud. Even the 50-watt one will blow your head off. just unbelievable that we put up with that. And picture Hendrix and Clapton with two double stacks playing right in front of that.
Holy cow.
They're deaf.
So what, can you tell everybody and myself exactly what the specs were and what model amp that was that Eddie bought? Because I think that's fascinating that he wanted that amp. They didn't know where to get it, but then he ended up with it anyhow.
Yeah, it was probably, the year was, I bought it out here.
Where at?
Valley News and Green Sheet. That's like the
one of memory,
the equivalent of Craigslist today, you know. And I bought it from some guy, and it was an old one from about 67 or 68, which didn't have the preamp, which came with the Mark II amps. Some of the early Mark IIs sound good, like Phil X has one that sounds great. And he said it's because initially they didn't have the preamp.
Well, one thing Van Halen did to make sure that the venues would really read their contract riders really carefully is they would say, we want, you know, this much food.
A certain amount of cigarettes, certain amount of cigarette lighters.
Breakfast for the crew at 6 o'clock. We need
this much beer, this type of beer. We want
this much staging.
Everything had to be exactly just so. In order to make sure that the promoters read the rider thoroughly in small print.
We want M&Ms, but with all the brown ones removed.
No brown M&Ms.
Well, if they're going to not read it,
they made that mistake.
Well, that means they're going to forget the 40 feet of staging or the 18 points for lighting. Band showed up. They saw brown M&Ms.
They missed brown M&Ms.
Flip out.
They trashed the room.
Most people just went there and did it on one weekend. You know, you go out and you party, and then it took you a week to recover, right? We did it every night.
Van Halen led the way to all of us deviants. I mean, they lived life huge.
Through years of arduous practice and playing the backyard party and small club circuit around Pasadena, California, Edward and Alex Van Halen, Michael Anthony, and David Lee Roth earned the right to enjoy the spoils of their success.
We worked real hard at being able to do it. You know, it's not like we were born with guitars and drums and voices that can sing, and like it was some gift.
And in the process, reinvented the landscape of hard rock music.
And when we heard Van Halen for the first time, it was like hearing Led Zeppelin for the first time or Jimi Hendrix for the first time. You knew it was something amazing.
And they were so fucking good, I had to hold on to my chair. I mean, they were full of full-blown energy nonstop.
Van Halen is a six-pack of beer, big-breasted woman riding down the highway, running over animals.
Pure, raw, unadulterated, you know, great rock and roll music.
The girls wanted them, and the guys wanted to be like them.
I was 11, rocking around the ghetto blaster, listening to Van Halen.
I think rock and roll existed so that original Van Halen could exist.
The four distinctive personalities that would later ignite the mighty Van Halen first flickered into the world during a time when a hip-swiveling rocker known as Elvis was recording his earliest tracks at Sun Records, and Marilyn Monroe was making her debut on the cover of Playboy. In Amsterdam on May 8, 1953, Jan Van Halen, a Dutch clarinet and saxophone player, and his wife Eugenia welcomed their first son, Alex.
When you put on a Van Halen record, even if you don't know that it's a Van Halen record, as soon as you hear that, I know it's him.
Most drummers have a certain style. As long as I can remember, it was two kick drums. I always liked the sense of rhythm that a double bass player had.
Everything used to be so far out there, you know, four kick drums and in the, you know, the hi-hats were always way up here. So you're talking about a lot of this kind of movement with your hands. And a lot of that comes from show.
If a guy can develop a sound that is really identifiable, I think that's a big achievement. And I think Alex did that.
A little over a year later, on June 20th, 1954, Michael Sobolewski, who later became known as Michael Anthony, was born in Chicago, the second of five children.
I mean, if you'd seen him on the street, you wouldn't know that he was some fucking kick-ass bass player, you know what I mean? And he was.
Without that high voice of Michael Anthony, where would they have been?
Can't imagine that band without that vocal. without that high-pitched sound. And when you really look at Van Halen, it's the guitar sound, it's that snare sound, Michael holding down the groove, and that vocal.
A few months later, on October 10th, David Lee Roth made a flying leap into a prominent surgeon's home in Bloomington, Indiana.
He folded the map in half, line runs right through New Castle County, Indiana, where I was born. And my music always came from that.
I think the guy's a genius. He's the world's greatest entertainer that ever lived in my eyes. You know, a lot of people will argue that with me, but one of the best front mans you're ever going to see ever.
David is a party animal. Let's face it, today, wine, women, and song, you read about it in papers, the same thing. He partied, man. Many days he'd take a chick out of here, come back 10 minutes later looking for another one. Chick, 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 that's it.
And finally, on January 26, 1955, in Amsterdam, Edward Van Halen was born, the last member to form the Mighty Van Halen.
You could always tell an Eddie Van Halen guitar, which to me is what makes a great guitar player. But he could do things technically as well, which is why I put him in, you know, in one of those top 10 guitar players in rock.
He has this part of his brain, which you would call semi-genius. He recognizes things very, very quickly that would take you and I some time to ponder on, or someone would have to show us, or we'd have to go to school, or we might have a bit of it, and we figure it out later. He just goes, that, I know that, okay, fine, that must happen there.
He created his own guitar, his own sound, and his own feel and emotion, and that's what drew people to him, his uniqueness, his individuality. And he changed the way music was played in the 80s, the way music was heard in the 80s.
I couldn't believe that someone could make that awesome sound. Never made a mistake when he was noodling, and always hit every note perfect and got better and better.
Early in their lives, Eddie and Alex's father began teaching his sons how to play piano. Mom provided constant encouragement in hopes that someday one of her boys might become a classical pianist.
Mr. Van Halen definitely played a major part in confidence. You know, he's a musician himself. And that house was always music.
The earliest memories I have, really, as far as musically, is that our father was into music, and you couldn't help but be touched by it. I'd watch him practice, I'd watch him play. Basically, Ed and I were surrounded by music.
America gained two of its most valuable musical imports in March of 1962 when Jan and Eugenia Van Halen settled with their two boys in the warm suburbia of Pasadena, California.
When we came on the boat to America, my dad would play in the band that was playing on the boat so that we could pay for our passage. We were flat broke when we came over here. And Ed and I would play piano. Okay, here's my dad playing on stage with the band, making some money so we could pay for our passage. And then it was kind of a novelty to have two kids playing piano.
When they moved here, they didn't speak English yet, so Eddie and Al could only talk to each other for a while, and that made them really bond.
And when Ed and I went to school, the only barrier that we had was our language barrier. We couldn't speak the language. We knew, I think, two words. Yes, and accident. Accident was the first word in the book that my mother had bought for us to learn English.
Ed and Al were brothers, you know, they got along on a 1 to 10. They were always on 10, you know, they were a really tight family.
Oh, that brother thing was always there. They fought a lot, they loved a lot, you know, great family guys, you know, real loyal people.
My parents bought me a guitar, and they bought me a silver tone amplifier, and I was playing the thing, and I, no matter what I tried, it just wasn't happening, man. Ed bought a drum set, and he had a paper route to pay for it.
The only honest job I've ever had was a paper route, and that was to buy a musical instrument.
While he was gone on his paper route, I'd be sitting there banging away on the drums. I really liked the drums. I don't know what it was.
One of the first things I remember is that Edward played the drums and Al played guitar. Come home from school one day and there's Edward on the guitar, Al's guitar.
I forget exactly how it happened, but eventually Ed and I switched. Ed played guitar and I played drums. I could tell by how he was imitating and listening to different people and being able to play the same thing that this guy knew what the hell he was doing.
When it came time to play around after school like kids do, Edward was always practicing, Alex was always practicing. They practiced at their small home in Pasadena, which wasn't big enough for a band to practice. So they'd find other people to be in the band so they could utilize the garage.
Michael Sobolewski also showed an early interest in music. Through his father, who played trumpet, Mike developed an appreciation not only for rock and roll, but for all styles of music, including jazz.
My father was playing like their father. My father was playing in a polka-type band. He played professionally a long time ago with Kay Kaiser in Chicago and stuff like that.
By the early 60s, David spent much of his time hanging out at his Uncle Manny's club, the Café Wa in New York City, where he witnessed performances by artists such as Bob Dylan and Jimi Hendrix.
New York certainly more closely reflects the dinner table that I grew up at when I was a kid. It either encouraged you mightily or discouraged you totally. Obviously, it encouraged me.
When Roth's family relocated to Pasadena, California, David's passion for rock music intensified, and with the Sobolewskis' recent move from the Windy City to nearby Arcadia, California in 1966, the stars aligned like notes on a perfect scale, with all the future members of the classic Van Halen lineup living in the same area. In 1971, teenagers Alex and Eddie Van Halen and friend Dennis Travis formed a new group, the Trojan Rubber Company. During the band's performances, Alex would often show off his accomplished drumming skills by playing Toad, the 20-minute drum solo made famous by Ginger Baker of Cream.
You look at some of the riffs that Ginger Baker did on the end of some songs, and you'll find that there's that lineage from Cream to Van Halen, too. We learn from our elders. We pass it down. If you're looking at Alex, he's looking at Ginger Baker when he's growing up, and you're looking at Eddie, he's looking at Eric Clapton. Now, you listen to Eric Clapton and you listen to Eddie Van Halen, you're not going to hear either one in each of them. But Eddie can sit there and play lick for lick anything that Eric ever did.
Ed would sit there and listen for hours on end to Eric Clapton. That was basically Clapton, I think. And you can't help but sit there. I mean, you try to emulate these people, it kind of gets into your fingers.
I know Clapton was that was the thing. I mean, they would warm up on Cream songs every day. Now, it's hard to make that sit and move forward. It's a very stationary, vertical thing. But they could do that.
Dave listened to a lot of different music, you know, a lot, rather than just the real popular stuff. You have to get it from somewhere. It either has to come from within, and if you don't have it within, then you have to get it from whatever is around you. We went down to a place that they were playing when we were like 15 or 16. I mean, this is how early Eddie and Alex were playing. We went to see him at this venue, and it was just a small place, but it was jammed, and they were in there, and they were doing Black Sabbath stuff is what Eddie and Alex were doing at that time. And Dave, and I think that was actually before Dave decided he really wanted to be a rock star, was when we went and saw that. And Dave saw all that energy and all that stuff in that room. It just sent a cold chill down your spine how good these guys were.
Van Halen. First play in a band, and I wasn't in the band back in high school. I listened to him play, I watched him play, and I said, you know what he does with his hands, I want to do with my feet. I want to do with my voice. He's kind of a mentor of mine.
After playing together for only a year, Dennis Travis's father got a job as a minister at a church 300 miles away. Alex and Edward quickly found another bass player, Mark Stone, and changed the name of the band to Genesis.
I went and jammed. We called us, come over and jam and see what happens, and it happened.
I think one of the first real impacts was Mark Stone, the bass player.
It was amazing that there was three people that could make that much music.
I knew it early on that they were both virtuosos. You know, they were few legendary guitar players, and I knew Edward was on his way to being there. Alex was the leader. He was like the driving force that gave the band the direction.
Soon, the fledgling band discovered there was another outfit, a far more successful and established band from England, also known as Genesis. Scrapping the name, the band decided to call themselves Mammoth instead. Edward handled lead vocals as well as guitar, and they continued playing high schools and backyard parties in the area.
I was 15 years old, and I went and I saw this band, Mammoth. And at the time, everybody was talking about them. For them at the time, I think it was like a big venue. It was Pasadena City College. And I didn't know what to expect, and I go in there, and there's this guy, Eddie Van Halen, that everyone had been talking about, who just played guitar like you couldn't believe. There was an energy going on. There was something happening, and there was, you know, this mass of people and this interest in what was going on. And you knew that it was more than just, like, you know, a local band playing.
I mean, they really worked hard. They played their dues. You know, they played in the shittiest places, but lugging all that gear, you know, to the worst places, you know, biker bars and high school dances and all these clubs, and you're getting home at 4 or 5 and when you're burnt out. You know, and they probably played more gigs than anybody.
Every opportunity for a show, they went and played. No one ever said, got something else, too tired. Every opportunity, we had our foot in the door.
Across town, David Lee Roth was steadily developing his own over-the-top stage persona while fronting his band, Red Ball Jet.
They had been practicing in his dad's basement of his office building in San Marino. And they'd been practicing for about 4 or 5 months, and they was getting more antsy to do bigger venues and be, you know, more popular.
I only saw Red Ball Jet once at the Civic. They were playing cover tunes too, but I think they were a little different. I think they were more R&B, if I recall. I don't know if they had a horn player or a keyboard player or something. I remember them being a little bit not the norm, you know.
During the summer, there was a guy who put on shows at Hamilton Park in Pasadena. That's where we met Dave and Red Ball Jet.
I think the Battle of the Bands kind of helped draw two forces together. Because otherwise, I think they would have just been playing in separate backyard parties. But then when they played together, and they both knew that they, you know, they weren't gun-shy. You know, we're ready to go. We'll battle any day. Edward and Alex, let's battle. Dave, let's battle. So there's three battle warriors right there. You put those three together, and it's pretty tough.
Ed was the lead singer at that time. And, you know, things started to kind of build up, and I started to notice that Ed couldn't really take the chores of being lead singer.
I think Edward and Alex wanted one other element. They needed that lead singer. At that time, you know, in the early 70s, it was kind of the look. You know, I mean, Cream worked with Jack Bruce singing, but Led Zeppelin was working better. You know, and Rolling Stones, you know, with the lead man.
We didn't have any PA equipment. When Red Ball Jet was out of work, when they didn't have a gig, I would approach Roth and ask him, you know, we'd like to rent your PA. And he would rent it to us. You know, give him $10. And this went on for a few months. And eventually I just said to Ed, look, you know, you're not really capable of being the front man and singer. I said, Ed, rather than paying Roth his $10 every time he rent his stuff, why not just get him in the band and we won't have to pay him $10, you know, and we'll have a lead singer. Because he, at that time, he walked around with a certain confidence that was good, I felt.
Dave and Van Halen decided that they would, you know, do it because they were good for each other. They were going to help each other. And there was a lot of talk that there was a new singer in the band, that Eddie wasn't singing anymore. The first time that I saw him was at this party, and it was a big party. And out comes this guy, you know, with this bigger-than-life personality, and everybody's like, whoa, you know, this is different, you know. What Dave offered was the sexuality that was probably, wasn't flamboyant before.
Everybody that I knew of at the time that was there, some of the early Van Halen gigs, had the same response. Probably the world's greatest guitar player. Great band. Singer's gotta go. And the reason for that was that Dave, at the time was such a blatant clone. I mean, that's really the word, of Jim Dandy.
The first time he came to see us was at Whiskey Go-Go, after we'd already been playing concerts ourselves and doing some headlining. And everybody says, there's like a young Jim Dandy down there somewhere. He was there with a home movie camera. I wanted to know if it's all right. He said, I dig the way you do a show. Kind of thing that I want to be, sight as well as sound. I want to give them a show and make them happy. And you work hard. And I said, sure, take all you want. Like I say, everybody asked me, what do you think about David Lee Roth stealing your thing? And he didn't steal nothing from me. I learned from other people, too. I was the first one with blonde hair. And he did a couple of the moves and poses, but he's got his own thing, man. I love watching him. He's entertaining to me.
Most of us that initially did not like Dave really began to like him and acquire the taste for him, because he developed more and more character and more color, and there was humor. There was great humor there with Dave, his wit.
Dave was doing his shit back then, too. I remember he was doing that. He was all decked out and dressed up. He had a cane that he was prancing around on stage. I mean, he was...
Like, this guy says the F-bomb, so I gotta let it be.
Dave was the dude.
I gotta hand it to him. He was rather unique. I mean, he wore clothes that people would never even think of wearing. He would wear skin-tight pants that he would find in Hollywood. You know, Hollywood at that time for us was like, oh my God, Hollywood.
Dave was the frontman to which all other frontmen were measured against. And some people will say the only bad thing about Dave is, well, his range isn't that good. He's not the greatest singer. Well, I don't really care. I just love his voice. His voice sounds cool.
Dave, to me, is, you know, the greatest entertainer that ever lived, you know. I mean, he knew how to stroke the audience. He still does.
The change came the moment that Roth joined the band. We figured we needed a new name, and it was Roth's idea. And he said, look, Van Halen sounds nice. It's different. It's your last name, and it can be a good band name. And so we decided to go with that.
Dave knew right away Edward and Alex were going, you know, they weren't going to back off. And they were awesome musicians. And they had the attitude that, you know, Pasadena is the first stop.
I remember at that time going around Pasadena and I was like famous, you know, everybody knew me. You know, they'd always be trying to give us booze and drugs and stuff. It was pretty nuts.
Somebody would have the balls to host a party at their house. And you'd send out flyers and you'd invite as many people as you could.
Well, they were pretty legendary, really. Back then, there was a lot of them, though. People don't seem to do that anymore, but every weekend, there'd be three or four. There'd be a band playing, or, you know, you'd pay a buck to get in, there'd be a keg. I don't know how... It was pretty loose as far as that goes. But if Van Halen were playing, you'd go over there, and there'd be 2,000 people, you know, in the backyard.
When the weekend came around, you pretty much wanted to know if Van Halen was playing everywhere, you know? You know, when Van Halen played, there'd be a lot of girls.
They would always try to make the band wait as long as possible, because we knew that once the band started, that's when the countdown began. Band started playing. We don't know when, but we know the police are going to show up sooner or later.
As the parties got bigger and bigger, I mean, eventually they became these massive swarms of people. You know, cars lined up for miles and, you know, bodies all over the street and everybody trying to get in. We might get an hour or two out of it and the cops are going to be there. And you look up and the helicopters are coming in with the spotlights and there's police cars blocking off the street.
Cops came and busted it. There was many cop cars there. The officer told me, you know, this party is so loud and so big. There's so many people in the street and all these cars. We were looking for the party four blocks down.
I remember one party where outside it got out of hand, and I think somebody actually got shot with a shotgun. God, it was nuts.
If it's your life and your lifestyle, where do you want to eventually end up? Hollywood.
He started playing Hollywood, really. Dave was very ambitious, so he knew if you want to get seen by somebody important, you got to play Hollywood, so they kind of focused on that after a while.
Early in 1974, Van Halen scored a coveted residency at the rock club Gazzari's, located on the Sunset Strip in West Hollywood. Landing this gig helped catapult the band out of Pasadena's backyard beer bashes and thrust them headfirst into Tinseltown.
We almost became like the house band. And it was funny because after all the years that we played there, I could never figure out why Bill Gazzari called Dave Van. You'd say, "Hey, Van, a couple extra dollars for you." He never knew that his name was Dave. He thought his name was Van Halen, like in Van Morrison.
Gazzari's was almost its own island, its own scene. No pro bands played at Gazzari's in any context. It was basically a place for young amateur bands to start out and really try and build their chops and build their talent.
So Mark Stone is a good bass player, you know. Listen to those tapes I've got. He's got some pretty good chops.
Mark, good bass player. Just not where his road was leading.
You know, I was a straight-A student in school and doing the band, and I was, like, split between these two things, and basically I just couldn't keep up with them. You know, in actuality, we met one day, and they actually asked me to leave.
The reason that we had to let Mark go was that it seemed that his interests were elsewhere than music.
For a long time, it really hurt. You know, it was tough. It was tough leaving that band, you know, because I knew they were destined for greatness, you know, and it's just like they say, you know, don't leave before the miracle happens, and I did.
The years after high school, from high school to getting discovered, was where everybody tested their mettle, because to a lot of people, you know, that was the end of the fun road. Now the hard work began. As the years go on, you have to kind of choose which direction you're going to go in. And I think that Edward and Alex knew where they were going. Mike Anthony was in a group called Snake. He was a great singer as well.
Mike was going to Pasadena College, and I know that he would run into either Alex and Dave, I think. You know, I don't think
this guy cusses with my gun.
But he knew of them.
I'll never forget the night we went to see Mike and his band Snake over at Pasadena High School in the auditorium, and things started happening right then.
We were doing a show at a place called Pasadena High School. And lo and behold, the PA blows up. Into the picture steps Michael Anthony, whose band named Snake has a PA, and he offered us the use of his PA.
After we got done, Eddie came out and he said, "Dude, where'd you get that bass player, man? Does that fucking guy play guitar?"
This guy cusses, I gotta be cool.
And I said, "Yeah, he doesn't play guitar, but I mean, he can pick it up and play it." Damn, he is fucking good. He tripped on it. He did. I remember he was doing finals in school, and then meet up at the rehearsal room. He goes, "Tony, I want you to listen to this." And I listened to it, and it had, I remember, it had four cuts on it. It had "Take Your Whiskey Home" on it, too, back then. And I was blown away. I was like,
"All right, shut up.
What the fuck I think for you? I mean, you got to do what you got to do."
And they asked him to audition, and they auditioned him one time and immediately asked him for the job, and he took it.
They kind of took the few pieces and put them together, the puzzle, and bam.
There was just a whole new presentation. I mean, all of a sudden, it was like, you know, front man. And it was a real rock and roll band.
They started playing immediately because Mike was so fucking good. I mean, what the hell did he have to learn? He knew everything. You know?
Shut up, stupid dude. I don't want no trouble.
Like, gold outfit making a big debut. And it was wild. Ed was wearing a cape. They were pretty wild. Here in the driveway playing this backyard party, and they sounded great, you know? I thought, wow, he's great. Mike is perfect.
Rapidly building a following, Van Halen strutted their stuff throughout Pasadena and Los Angeles. The band's repertoire was eclectic, to say the least.
They knew 300 songs, other people's songs, and at first they would only play all the covers, "Get Down Tonight" by Casey and the Sunshine Band, you know, Aerosmith songs, Zeppelin, ZZ Top, and they would slowly work their own originals in, "Running with the Devil," DOA, "House of Pain," really old stuff.
That's one thing, too, about Van Halen. They would kick.
You're so good.
I mean, and mix it up.
After Gazzari's, it was like every other club. Say we had, you have like top 40 stuff that you play. KC, we did a couple of those. That's the kind of stuff to get into the club. Uh-huh. Then after that, you start edging in your own original stuff.
Eddie said that it never sounded just like the band they were playing, and it was kind of frustrating because it always had the Van Halen sound, which was really probably a good thing.
Van Halen personified a certain kind of California culture. If you know California, if you live here and you know what California looks and sounds and feels and smells like, all of that was captured in Van Halen's music.
But they were local boys, so obviously we're rooting for them. And I had seen I'd seen them like at Troubadour and places in Pasadena.
In Pasadena, everyone knew about them. But they decided they were going to take it up a notch.
Finally, we did a show at a place called Golden West Ballroom in Norwalk, California, with a UFO. Rodney Bingenheimer was the big MC.
Let's welcome, if you will, from Pasadena, ladies and gentlemen, Van Halen!
And it was like the first all-original set we ever did as a band, and it was like this place was like 1,500 to 2,000 people. People loved it, and Rodney Bingenheimer really...